This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play Music, Reason.com, or wherever you want to. But when you get there, rate and review us and let us know how you're doing as well. Today, we're talking with Elizabeth Nolan Brown, who's a reporter, a researcher, and editor at Reason, who has published a bombshell story about the federal case against Backpage.com. Which was an internet online classified system that has been accused of fomenting and empowering child sex traffickers all over the world. These are two guys who helped create alternative media, particularly free weeklies, for the past 30 or 40 years, going back to 1970. They are now under house arrest. Liz, thanks for talking to us.
Yeah, hi. Happy to be on here.
So, inside or independent media veterans James Larkin and Michael Lacey are currently languishing, waiting under house arrest. So I guess that's good. But they have a trial coming up in 2020 for supposedly being involved in all kinds of illegal activities stemming from Backpage.com, an online advertising system that was widely used by people who were sex workers. What is the case against them, and what's going on there?
Yeah, so if you sort of listen just to what people have said, what politicians have said, and the prosecutors, and then unfortunately very often what media has reported, it's been that this is a sex trafficking case. But, the actual charges against them are money laundering and facilitating prostitution. And they are basically there's two things. They're accused of facilitating prostitution because they ran an ad, a website that was, user generated ads. And a lot of them were, were ads for illegal adult entertainment and sort of things like strippers and various things. But there was also a lot of, like you said, thinly veiled disguises for prostitution.
And this is like escort ads and stuff like that, or where,
under a section called escorts.
Right.
Yeah. So they actually were no longer the heads of this site, but they had founded it back in 2004. So they're accused of facilitating prostitution. They are also charged with a bunch of counts of money laundering, and it's complicated how they characterize those. But a lot of it actually comes back to the fact that they had to seek alternative payment arrangements for people paying for ads on Backpage because the government had specifically sort of cut off their traditional funding methods. You had both financial regulators pressuring banks to stop doing business with adult-oriented businesses. And so you had traditional banks dropping them. And then you had a sheriff in Chicago, Sheriff Tom Dart, who pressured credit card companies into stopping doing business with them. And they challenged this, and it was later found to be unconstitutional by a federal court. And the Supreme Court even declined to hear the case. So this was a totally unconstitutional act so that they couldn't use credit cards. But when they couldn't use credit cards, they started accepting Bitcoin, and they started using their own payment processing company, or it's sort of complicated, but they had people mail money orders. And so they're saying that the things that they did in direct response to this sort of unconstitutional government overreach into their financial processes, now they're saying that their responses are money laundering.
And
is part of it.
One of the ironies in your investigative piece, which is up at Reason.com and is really just one of the most, I hate to say it's a great read because it's an infuriating account of injustice unfolding right in front of us, but it is a must read if anything, is one of the innovations that Backpage had brought to online advertising for kind of sex work and whatnot was that the advertisers or people had to pay with a credit card and kind of show that they were they were who they said they were within certain limits, so that you didn't get a lot of like freakazoids or people who just didn't really exist and were actually going to hurt people that they were advertising for.
Yeah. And I mean, they found there's a lot of sort of back and forth in these internal court documents that are between, both internally at Backpage and between prosecutors about how that didn't exactly work because people would get prepaid credit cards. And that's actually how they found that a lot of underage people who would end up posting, even though that was banned, they wouldn't use pictures and they would say they were above 18 and they would buy prepaid credit cards. So It was not a perfect system, but that is something that they actually did. Backpage actually did start requiring a credit card in order to post in the adult section at the specific request of law enforcement and of the federal government through the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And that's just actually sort of one of many things that they did at the request of the federal government. Like they had monthly meetings with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They banned certain terms that they recommended. They responded to all sorts of law enforcement subpoenas. They, quicker than any other company, law enforcement has routinely said. They had a tip line, missing children's tip line at the top of their website. So they really did try to work, until it was just impossible, but they really tried to work with law enforcement to ferret out underage people on the site. I mean, they took that really seriously. So whatever you say
right,
about...
Or people who were...
Whatever you want to say about like the adult prostitution that, they have been facilitated on the site, sure. But like they really did take it seriously that they were trying to, stop, people that were minors from being posted on there or posting themselves on there.
So, I mean, and they were celebrated and lauded by various members of both federal law enforcement community, but also local branches.
Yeah.
So they go from being almost... poster children for responsible work with law enforcement. And also, it's not like they were divulging secrets. I mean, they would follow, subpoenas or court orders and things like that. But they were the good guys. What happened that suddenly, was it something Backpage did, or was there a kind of social shift to, from the idea that escort work ads and things like that could be done in a responsible way to, this is all evil and we've got to stop this?
Well, I mean, I think you kind of have two things going on here. And, just to back up a second, just say here, because before we talk anymore about this, that, I've been reporting on Backpage now for years and just general issues surrounding sex trafficking and sex work and speech and things like that. But I also just got to go out in July and, as I say in the story, I got to go out in July and actually spend some time and meet and interview the two founders, Michael Lacey and James Larkin, in person. And I learned, a lot of stuff that is out there, but I think has not been, it actually was reported a lot in the 80s and 90s, but stuff that then had just sort of been forgotten, which is that these are, like you said, two guys who, they found it, they started at the Phoenix New Times, a free alt weekly in Phoenix in 1970, and were working on that. And then they had a bunch of other ones. They started buying up ones in other cities. And their whole sort of aesthetic was that they definitely, didn't have any sort of alliances with, they didn't seek access. They didn't shy away from any different group, reporting on anybody in power, whether they were in government or business or cops, they didn't shy away from reporting on people first in Phoenix and then in all these cities. And they really made enemies of people like John and Cindy McCain and Sheriff Joe Arpaio and Kamala Harris. So you have some of that where just for years and years and years, they sort of, these two men personally earned a lot of hate from people in very high power positions.
So, and this, I mean, they're accused of being a kind of espousing a desert libertarianism in their alt weeklies. They became eventually one of the biggest chains, or they owned, huge numbers of alt weeklies in the New Times chain for a while. They even owned the Village Voice, which is by some people considered, the first, and until recently, at least, was certainly the most prestigious of the alt weeklies, started in the 50s by people like Norman Mailer and whatnot. But these guys had made a lot of enemies precisely because they did the best type of thing that alt weeklies did, was piss off the local power brokers and the local authorities, right? So that's part of the story here then, that Lacey and Larkin, again, based in Phoenix or in the in Arizona, they had run afoul of John and Stacey McCain, that's a different type of power broker, I suppose. But John and Cindy McCain and Joe Arpaio, how did that factor into, like, what did they do that got the McCains and Arpaio pissed at them? And then we'll talk about Kamala Harris, who is, one of the darlings of the new kind of Democratic Socialist Alliance, progressive wing of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. So, I mean, they just were, they were reporting on, basically they were reporting on these people, and that's what made them angry. That's what pissed them off. But, you know, starting back even in the 70s, they reported on John McCain critically. They reported on his involvement, later him and Cindy's involvement with this guy, Charles Keating, who was a big scammer on the savings and loan scandal. And they were, you know, flying on his private jet and stuff. So they hit him hard on that. They later sort of exposed when Cindy McCain had been stealing drugs that she got for a children's medical charity and stealing the drugs from the children and then lying and forging prescriptions. And they exposed that. So, I mean, their papers did a lot of things. Later, they got in a fight with Sheriff Joe Arpaio because they published a story about his real estate dealings, and it included his home address as part of it. And he said that not only did they have to take it down, but that they needed to give him, the story had been up for 3 years by the time he noticed it and got mad, but that he needed to give them 3 years worth of data on everybody who had ever visited the New Times website. Not just the Stephen story, but the whole website in that time. So, you know, they said no, and they got subpoenaed before they had a grand jury, and they weren't supposed to talk about it. But then the prosecutors were crooked, so they wrote a story about it, and Arpaio raided their houses and had them arrested in the middle of the night. And long story short, they ended up getting a almost $4 million settlement from the county years later, and used that to fund Mexican rights and migrant rights causes with the money that they got from Arpaio settlement. So
what cool. About where did they where do they cross swords with Kamala Harris, the former Attorney General of California, who's now a senator, and by, you know, seemingly everybody, it's obvious she's going to be running for president in 2020.
Yeah. So, I mean, to get back to, you know, when I say that these people, I mean, part of it is obviously that, yes, some people do have direct grudges against them, I think, in power. But it's also, I tell you this to sort of explain, like, where they're coming from, because I think a lot of people think, like, okay, like, who are these two old dudes who are just, like, really, really, really fighting hard to be able to have this website that a lot of people just think of as, even if not a sex trafficking website, at least people that think of as, like, a sex work website, you know? Right. And I think people, so I think it helps to understand that, you know, they have been, in addition to these, like, you know, writing these articles, they've been in court a billion times. They've actually been, you know, it's just, that's what they do. It's not like this is an anomaly. It's not like they're like, yes, we're really going to fight for this. Like they have been fighting for these things all along, and also kind of, you know, had an attitude about it, as I think, you know, good journalists should towards people in power. But they, the National Association of Attorneys General, started around making it a big priority that they were going to, deal with human trafficking by, getting rid of Craigslist erotic services ad section. So, and this is when, you know, Kamala Harris was an attorney general of California, and this National Association of Attorneys General, they start hounding Craigslist and saying, you know, you need to take down your things. We're going to prosecute you if you don't. And Craigslist finally, after 2 years of this and like campaigns and, you know, various people calling for all sorts of, you know, terrible things about Craigslist, they cave and they take down the erotic services section, which is anyone who visited Craigslist, like personal section or anything after that, or just like gigs section, like you could see that it was still full of adult ads and sex ads of various sorts. But they literally, you know, took the words off their website, and it also didn't require a credit card anymore. So then everything was just free. So as soon as they got them to do that, the Association of Attorneys General got really, and their acronym, this is great, their acronym is NAG, so I'm just going to call it NAAG. So right. NAG got really excited when Craigslist did what it wanted. And then it was like, all right, well, now Backpage, because Backpage then actually ended up getting a ton of ads. Until that, Backpage had been, you know, doing okay, but it hadn't been a premier classified ad site for anything, really, you know, for regular, for just goods or jobs or sex or escort ads, you know. But it started getting a lot more of all of those things, and especially of the escort ads and the general adult ads when Craigslist closed. So then NAG was like, okay, we need to go after them. And they were like, hey, you've got to take down your adult services section of your website. And they're just like, no, we're not going to do that. And, you know, I go into a lot of detail about this in the story, so I won't babble on too long here. But, you know, they start trying to work with all these people in all these different ways, including this Association of Attorneys General and the Missing Children's Center and blah, 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 the FBI. They're working with everybody, and they're trying to find ways to actually, you know, take their, like, they're working with Polaris Project and all these charities too, and just take their suggestions about how they can be better monitors of their site, how they can, you know, better work with them and everything. But they won't do this thing that they think is just stupid and ineffective. I mean, Liz McDougall, who's Backpage's counsel, said that in 2012 to the New York City council. I forget why she was talking to them, but she was like, look, like Craigslist is getting applauded as a hero and it hasn't made any difference at all. And we're not going to do this thing that's just symbolic just to like get, you know, applause that's not actually going to help. But to the Association of Attorneys General, that just sort of looked like, you're not doing what we say. And they'd already put out like a gazillion press releases and made a huge deal of this. So it sort of became a thing, like almost like a point of pride, you know? It was just like,
what was, so it's because they wouldn't change the names, or they wouldn't take down the certain section headings?
Yeah, they wouldn't take down the section. Yeah.
I see.
That's basically all it came down to. And so, real quick, here's where Kamala Harris comes into, is that, you know, she was one of the attorneys general who signed on then after Backpage wouldn't listen and they'd sent them a bunch of letters. Finally, in 2013, they were like, all right, fine. You know what? If Backpage isn't going to do what we want, we're going to go after them. And they had, you know, in several civil court cases found that Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, this federal law, was sort of preventing state prosecutors from going after them for things that, for prostitution.
Right, because, and so just very, were, very quickly to define, and correct me if I'm incomplete here or off base, but what Section 230 did, it made the internet, or it made journalism on the internet possible, because it basically said that websites were not responsible for, they're not the publisher of everything that's on their site, so that somebody in a comment section who slanders somebody or libels somebody, or if you have a bulletin board and somebody puts up an activity or advertises for an illegal activity, the owner of the website is not necessarily responsible for that. There's a safe harbor there.
Yes. And yes, that's correct. The important thing also, though, about Section 230 is that it doesn't apply to federal crime. Mm-hmm. So there was nothing stopping the federal government. And in fact, they've been investigating Backpage since over 5 years ago. So, there was nothing stopping them from going after it for federal crimes. But it meant that, the state prosecutors couldn't get a piece of that action and they wanted it. So they wrote, and Kamala Harris is one of the attorney general that signed on and was big about talking about it at the time, that they wrote in 2013 to Congress and were like, look, you've got to amend Section 230 so that we can prosecute Backpage. I mean, they didn't even, that was like the second sentence of the letter. It wasn't even like, because, you know, lots of sites. It was specifically like, we are going, which is insane if you realize how many websites on the internet, including places like Facebook and Snapchat and Instagram and Twitter and the big social media companies, but also just tons of smaller websites, have, escort advertising or prostitution advertising and such. So,
and it's, there's that, you know, added, but they were like, weird irony that with, you know, one of the things that the alt weekly industry was built on were ads for the, like, you know, classified ads for this kind of stuff, which they then lost to Craigslist because it was freer and cheaper and it was easier to do. And then, and so then Backpage, built by guys who had lost so much money because of the changes in advertising habits and platforms, come back and now they're in manacles, essentially, right? They have beeper bracelets on there.
Tell me. They're not confined to their house. They can go within anywhere in the county. But yeah, they've got GPS ankle, like sort of shackles, digital shackles, sort of.
What happened to create the panic? And you've written a lot about this, but somehow we went from thinking, you know, people, adults generally are okay. We should allow them to, you know, pursue consensual agreements, you know, whether it's prostitution, whether it's smoking weed, et cetera. Like, we were moving in a liberal direction, kind of, in terms of certain types of lifestyle, victimless, consensual relationships between adults. What happened to flip the switch on the idea that all prostitution or all sex work is, by definition, sex trafficking, typically involving underage girls?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a lot of factors, but it's something that has been planned and plotted by a group of people who were invested in that outcome, is for sure. What I mean by that is that, you know, yes, like you said, people were, and you can look at surveys, you know, people were more and more, even into the 90s and early 2000s, starting to be, even say more people would say yes, prostitution between consenting adults would be legal. You know, there was some, you know, and
no, and it's just kind of like, God damn it, like at an age after 9/11 or something like that, and with a government that's broke and with cops, you know, kind of being problematic in lots of different ways, people were finally saying, you know what, maybe policing prostitution is not that big a deal. We can let that slide because we got bigger, you know, we got bigger problems. And,
yes,
but then, you know, what is it, just like Ashton Kutcher and a couple of, you know, random tweets later that all of a sudden, no, it's actually this, we're in the midst of an epidemic of sex trafficking.
No, I mean, what feels like an overnight thing was really like, I mean, it started at the start of the Bush years, it started at the end of the Clinton years, which is you had a bunch of, which I think is the terrifying alliance of sort of the old moral majority, the old Christian conservatives and people that wanted to ban, you know, video games and rap music, and this sort of academic, you know, what are called rad femmes, radical feminists, this sort of academic second wave feminists that was very anti-porn, anti-sex work, anti-sort of sex in general. The sort of caricature of, I know Andrea Dworkin didn't really say it, but the all sex is rape sort of types, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you have this sort of alliance of this religious group who just think all prostitution is bad. And then this, you know, radical feminists who think the same thing, and they sort of, you know, there's actually like documents of them saying, you know, like, we need to reframe this as all prostitution is sex trafficking. And so you see them start to get a little support for it under Bush, and you see him start to give money to these religious groups. And then, you know, fast forward, it only picks up under Obama, actually, because then they're able to take it from the other angle, which is the stop the sexual exploitation of women. And, you know, they're riding the sort of Title IX and the anti-sexual harassment stuff, so it's sort of just ballooned then, and it just sort of became a thing. But I mean, you have people like, there's a woman named Swanee Hunt, who was an ambassador under Clinton, who this has been her whole huge thing. And one of the things I mentioned in the article is that, you know, she hired a PR firm in 2010. It was the same PR firm that the Justice Department had already hired to study demand for prostitution, which means people who, you know, pay for it, the customers. And she hired a PR firm to convene a huge conference of like 100 stakeholders who would all later go on to Target, Backpage in various ways almost, and Craigslist. And they come up with this huge report about how, and to stop sex trafficking, we need to end demand. And in order to do that, we need to reframe all prostitution as, you know, anybody who pays for sex is contributing to sex trafficking. Any website that contributes to adult prostitution, sex trafficking. And so you actually had a really, really coordinated effort from both sort of the NGOs and these influential, well-conducted sort of socialite activists and the government that were all sort of working together to define it that way.
Yeah, and you know,
and then,
when
you know, that's a really easy sell in the media too.
Yeah, and I was going to say, even the Girl with Dragon Tattoo books, which were so gigantic for, you know, during this period, that the backstory of that is all about sex trafficking. And the Millennium Magazine is putting out blockbuster stories about international sex trafficking. Is there reason to believe, I guess before we come back to Backpage and the implications of the prosecution of them, not just for kind of sex work, but also for freedom of speech, are there reasons to believe that there is more sex trafficking going on globally or in North America or among young, among, I guess all sex trafficking by definition is a non-consensual, but that is, you know, is there a massive increase in sex trafficking, or is this a major misunderstanding of a different set of processes?
No, yeah, it's definitely, I mean, I don't want to speak to the global situation. I'm not, you know, as well versed on that, but I will say that definitely within the United States, there is no evidence that there has actually been an uptick of, you know, under federal law, forced prostitution or coerced, or if anyone is underage, even if they don't have a trafficker, that's trafficking. So if we're talking about forced or underage, there's no evidence that there's been an uptick in that. And there's a lot of good evidence to suggest that it has decreased, at least when we talk about underage prostitution, just because, you know, there's such more, just a taboo against, you know, even older teenagers, against people that are adults, you know, dating and having sex with teenagers. I mean, not saying that used to be except, but, you know, it,
right. No, I mean, Roman Polanski in the 1970s, he had You know, he had absolute, like, A-list people defending him having sex, which he ultimately admitted was was coerced. But, I mean, that people were like, oh, you know, that's not such a big deal. I mean, she was 13, for Christ's sake. You know, come on. We're not talking about child, you know, a child here or something. So social mores are definitely different than they were 30 or 40 years ago, and they are more protective of young girls.
Yeah, and I mean, in a way, like in many, many, many ways, that's a good thing, and it's really good, and that yeah. that means that it's also contributed to the number of underage people in sex work, having decreased, it seems, based on things like the number of arrests and things like that, and based on, you know, reports from law enforcement and things like that. But also, you know, it's created this this crazy thing where it's, you know, someone is. We even see things where, like, in these operations, 1 year, someone is 1 month shy of their 18th birthday, and they're 17, and they get picked up in a prostitution sting. They get arrested because they have a fake ID saying they're 18. Then cops find out they're 17. So then they take their name and mugshot off the internet. They put them in their victim tally and say how they saved a sex trafficking victim. The following year, gets picked up in the same sting the next year and gets charged as a sex trafficker. So it's like, it's, I mean, you know, it's just sort of the way we've looked at, they've started looking at this is very strange and chaotic. And, you know, in addition to the, to that, you also just have it being more visible, in a way, which is also actually a good thing, paradoxically, you know, because like it used to be if people wanted to, you know, look for, I mean, obviously there were escort ads, and agencies and stuff, but also a lot more prostitution took place on the streets, which meant it only took place in certain areas or zones and neighborhoods and usually, you know, more lower income or off the beaten track places. So most people just didn't see it. And now when you have much more prostitution advertising being online, even though that makes it usually safer for the people who are doing it consensually and even safer for people who are, you know, who are not doing it consensually, because it's still just, you know, but it, you have it so much more visible. Anybody can pull up a site and look and see this stuff. And I think that that has really sort of, you know, made people think and made it easy too to for the narrative to say that it's out of control because people didn't used to be able to see that and witness it themselves.
So
the fact that like any prostitution was taking place.
Right. I mean, these are people who had never bought a futon, right? In a smaller mid-sized city where you would get the free alt weekly and go to the back to buy a futon, which they would have futon ads that were then sandwiched by, you know, escort ads or whatever. So let's take it back to the kind of legal case for Backpage. The guys involved in Backpage are waiting until 2020 to get their trial. And that's the prosecutors. The defense is not saying, hey, we need at least until 2020 in order to get our, you know, to get our story straight. It's the prosecution saying, hey, we couldn't possibly, you know, present our case before 2020. That's kind of odd, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, especially because they've been, you know, we've had a congressional subcommittee investigation into Backpage. We've had federal attorneys looking into them for like 6 years. We've had all these, you know, there's so much out. Like, it's not like there's really a lot that they could. Anyways, yeah, it's weird that they would need that much time, except that, you know, they are. In the meantime, they are trying to do everything in their power to make life difficult for the defendants, which includes Lacey and Larkin and also several other. The CEO of Backpage, Farrar, Carl Farrar, he pled guilty, and we'll talk about that in a second if you want. But there's still several other executives that are charged with them. And, you know, they are the prosecution is, even though they're saying, OK, we can't go to trial until 2020, but they're putting them on, you know, they're monitoring the CBS monitoring. They're seizing their bank accounts and frozen their bank accounts. They're trying to seize their houses. They're trying to have their lawyers disqualified for pretty much all of their lawyers that they've ever worked with throughout their, time owning Backpage or their newspapers. So they're just really sort of they're going after them in all these capacities. And they've been very difficult. I mean, you can see all this in the court documents too. There's been a bunch of back and forth because they've been very difficult about providing discovery. The latest thing yesterday is that they were like, fine, we'll give you all of our, you know, because you have to, you know, the government has to give them the documents that they have as evidence. And they're like, fine, we'll give it to you. But it's like something like 6 terabytes or something. I don't know. It's enormous and they need special software to do it. And in order to like host the discovery and go through it, it would cost like $100,000 a month or something. And the government's like, well, we fulfilled our requirement. So they're just sort of thwarting them at every
They're using every kind of arrow in the prosecutor's quiver that's been tapped into, you know, botulism or human waste and shooting it at the defendants here, right? I mean, this is, it's a classic case trying to run them, you know, run them down to nothing. Everybody who would cooperate with them, all of the peripheral people, like, obviously it makes sense to cut a deal or to, you know, plead guilty or flip.
Right. Yeah. That's, and I mean, that's what they think that they're trying to get them to plead out because.
So what,
they don't think, you know, there's, they say that they don't think they're lawyers and they don't think they can win in court. So they want to, you know.
Now, one of the things that's interesting is that this was actually taking place before the FOSTA legislation got pushed through. Explain there, but in the popular imagination, it seems like this is all part and parcel of the same thing. And from if you believe that sex trafficking is increasing and is everywhere and needs to be stopped, this is all kind of, these are all movements in the right direction. But what is FOSTA and how does that play into the larger narrative that is surrounding the idea that it's a good thing that a website that allowed people to post advertisements for just about anything, including sex work, is being shut down, and that it's you know, its creators and owners are going to be put in jail for the rest of their lives by the federal government?
Yeah, so FOSTA, it accomplished what the attorney generals wanted for years now, which was an amended Section 230 so that state prosecutors and people bringing civil, you know, civil tort actions and suits can go after websites for facilitating prostitution or sex trafficking. And it also then makes a federal crime to host any content for a digital platform or publisher to host any content that facilitates or promotes prostitution. And that's why it's kind of crazy, because it really was sold as a sex trafficking thing, and it doesn't stop at sex trafficking. It says any sort of adult prostitution, consensual prostitution between adults is, you know, now if you advertise it, if you are found to not just even advertise it directly, right, but do something that's sort of broad, if you facilitate it. So you see, you know, people being so afraid of this now that they are breaking this law, that they just are removing all sorts of content that has anything to do with sex work, even like some sort of education things or like things where people who were like sharing information about bad clients to help keep them safe was shut down, because you just have this sort of, you know, paranoia that now you could be guilty of this huge federal, companies could be guilty of this huge federal crime. And so that's what FOSTA did. But it was really also, yes, sold as a way to target Backpage, and it didn't pass. It wasn't signed into law until after they were arrested, and their prosecution was way, way, way underway before that. And it, you know, had nothing to do with relying on charges that were necessary under FOSTA. And I think, you know, part of that is the two things are that people want to get rid of politicians want to get rid of Section 230. I mean, like entirely. And so chipping away at it is good from their end, because, you know, there's all sorts of things that I've now seen different people talk about, you know, whether it be for gun sales that end up, you know, being used in crimes, or for, there was the Democrats just proposal or something about, fake news, like fake Russian bots and stuff, facilitating that, you know, they shouldn't be allowed to get a pass for that. So you want, there's people who want to just demolish Section 230, and this is a step. But one more thing is that you had a lot of people who wanted to, who had sold this as necessary to stop Backpage. You had so many people saying that, like, constantly for years in Congress. And they knew there's, you know, some evidence that they knew that the prosecution was happening, and if it was going to happen before they passed it, they would have not maybe been able to pass it, or at least not been, you know, they would have been proven wrong. So you had people like the Senate, Bob Goodlatte on the judiciary saying, don't pass this. You had the Justice Department saying, this is a flawed bill, don't pass this. I mean, they all wanted some version of it, but they were saying the version that passed, this is flawed, don't do it. You had all this leadership. And then you had the House leadership, though, and the Republicans and various people saying, no, we're going to pass this right now. Like, and they rushed it through a vote and they got it through. And so it's almost as if, I mean, it seems as if they wanted to get it before Backpage was arrested so that it would look like it had been part of it and that they could say that, but it, you know, it was totally unconnected.
Now, the Backpage guys have also, Lacey and Larkin also, they have a fair amount of detractors in the press, right? In the legacy media, in the sense of, you know, they were the guys who, you know, first off, they were alt weeklies. So, you know, the traditional newspapers kind of hated their guts because the traditional role of the alt weekly, whether it's something like the Village Voice or Phoenix New Times, is to make fun of the mainstream media and also like the local power boosters. But then, you know, as their ownership of alternative weeklies, alt weeklies started growing out, people would get pissed like, oh, you know, Phoenix New Times, that's okay. But then when you come into Los Angeles, you're fucking with our alt weeklies. Get out of here. How, you know, are Lacey and Larkin getting support from other people in the media who, or is it mostly like it couldn't have happened to two worse people?
Yeah, it's funny because I hadn't really realized that till I started reading a bunch of 80s and 90s articles about New Times, and it was like, oh, they were the bad. I mean, they were like the Barnes and Noble or the. I mean, not actually, but that's sort of what they were portrayed as.
They're the Darth Vaders who are just coming in with, you know, enormous amounts of money and power. And it didn't help that they were kind of libertarianish, too.
Right. They weren't the sort of mainstream, little progressive sort of thing, I think, at a lot of these papers, so that people didn't like that. That was funny. But, you know, I think that I don't know how other like alt papers are really covering this stuff, you know, but in general, in the mainstream press, it's been the coverage of Backpages has been horrifying. I mean, the coverage of sex trafficking stuff in general is generally, you know, very panic worthy and just repeats what politicians say and is very horrifying. So it's not surprising, but I couldn't help but wonder like how much of like, especially like in their hometown, the main paper and stuff. And just, I can't help but wonder how much of it is certain people who are like their papers attacked these mainstream papers in these towns for many, many years. And, but you know, if you talk to people who worked with, Lacey and Larkin, they have, I mean, so many nice things to say from people who have worked with them back in the days. And they worked with a lot of people who have gone on to be, you know, really people worked with their papers, like Jack Schaefer, who's now a media critic at Politico. And stuff. So they've got a lot of people, you know, and people generally, it seems like, who work with them have really great things to say about them. I got to meet people who were some of their first writers.
As a final question, and again, this story is an absolute must read at Reason about the longstanding attack, legal case, federal case against Backpage by Liz Brown. Do you feel like are people in the media or maybe it's not, we can't rely on people in the media, but elsewhere, kind of getting hipped or gaining more understanding about the idea that stories like this, or, you know, and especially going after things like Section 230 and the Communications Decency Act, really give an enormous amount of power to prosecutors, that we should be thinking twice about. You know, one of the things that's fascinating over the past 10 or 15 years has been a generalized scrutiny of prosecutorial abuse, about criminal justice reform, where you realize certain people have too much power in a system that is supposed to be, you know, kind of a level playing field. Do you feel like Section 230, which is being eroded in the name of stopping sex traffic, are people in the media or outside the media coming around to the idea that, you know, we're being sold a really kind of fake story here, and it's going to end with us being able to have less expression online?
You know, I think definitely like people in the, sort of particularized tech media space, and the legal media, especially like constitutional lawyers, they warn about it. I think that, you know, libertarian writers and media, obviously, which is not a lot of, but even some people on the right even are more likely, because they, I think, maybe are more used to sort of feeling marginalized online and things, and, you know, worrying about that. So I think people on the right being media are also sometimes cognizant of it. But I think within the mainstream, you know, newspapers and press, and on the left-leaning and progressive end of things, that there's not really at all. And it's sort of astonishing because especially on the, you know, more on the liberal or progressive end of things, you'll have, you know, the people who are saying this stuff about, you know, yeah, about police and prosecutorial misconduct and are really, you know, aware of that, except when you start to bring in sex crimes or especially if you bring in, you know, prostitution or call it sex trafficking. And, you know, then you start to have just none of that. Like, it's just like that just was just like, boom, it's just like gone. It's like, oh, everything the prosecution said about this must just be like gospel. It's like they just totally forget that, like, in any other situation we've been talking about on other pages, that it's been, you know, that prosecutors are dirty and cops can be dirty, but then it's, you know.
So, but not here.
Yeah, it's kind of frustrating.
Well, we will leave it there. I think, you know, at the end of the day, if you're a journalist and you're not saying, you know, it's kind of frustrating, you probably only put in half a day, right? So we have been talking with Elizabeth Nolan Brown of Reason. She has a true blockbuster piece up that everybody should be reading at Reason.com. The title is "The Senate Accused Them of Selling Kids for Sex. The FBI Raided Their Homes." Backpage.com's founders speak for the first time. An inside look at how indie media veterans James Larkin and Michael Lacey became the targets of a federal witch hunt. Elizabeth, thanks for the real classic shoe leather reporting that you did on this. It's a powerful, important story. And I think everybody will be better off for having read it. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you very much. And thank you for having me on here to talk about it.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, Music at Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcast on, and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.